This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. I have two completely different, but yes, not always completely different, mostly very different guests on this afternoon. The first is Geraldine Brooks, reporter turned novelist, who's best known probably for her first book, Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, which came out a dozen years ago, and her second novel, March, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2006. She has a new novel called People of the Book, which has risen very quickly to the top of the bestseller lists. It's number one on the San Francisco Chronicle list, and I think number two on the New York Times. Geraldine Brooks will be speaking as part of the California Lecture Series at the Crest Theater in Sacramento at 7:30 p.m. this coming Wednesday, the 6th. Welcome to Booktown.
Good to be with you.
You've been very active as a journalist. You were a journalist for quite a few years, wrote a number of books, and then suddenly turned to fiction. And I think many of our listeners might know you best as a novelist. Although the book of yours that I find most in demand among my customers, I'm a used book dealer, is your first, Nine Parts of Desire. I get a request for it about once a month, and the other books a little less often. That's a very exhaustive examination of the lives of women in the Middle East, and both very encouraging in some ways and very discouraging in others. Why did you turn from being a reporter to being a novelist?
I was a journalist for more than a decade, and my career sort of unexpectedly led me into covering places in crisis, I guess would be the best way to sum it up. I started as a Middle East correspondent and spent 6 years intensely involved in that region, and Nine Parts of Desire, the book that you mentioned, was a distillation, I guess, of what I learned about the various ways that Muslim women negotiate their lives in the different cultures and the different traditions of their various societies. But after the Middle East, I went on to cover crises in Africa and the Balkans, and it was while I was covering a story about Shell Oil and how Shell was in league, I guess you could say, with the very brutal military dictatorship of Abacha in Nigeria to suppress a nonviolent protest movement by subsistence farmers, where Shell was extracting oil from their lands, but not using the kind of environmental safeguards and standards that they use when they're doing this work in European places or in the West or anywhere, indeed, under scrutiny. And I got arrested at that time, and I was briefly thrown into the lockup in Port Harcourt in Nigeria. And They hadn't really officially charged me, and I had no idea how long they intended to keep me there. And it was on about the third day of my imprisonment, and I was wondering if this was going to be like Terry Anderson's imprisonment that had lasted more than 7 years in Lebanon. And I thought, gosh, if they keep me that long, I'll be too old to get pregnant. So it was, if you like, a clarifying moment for me, so that when my son was born the following year, I just decided that having a job that meant going off on long open-ended assignments to dangerous places wasn't really something that I could be doing anymore.
Though when you had been a correspondent in the Middle East, your husband had accompanied you to some degree.
Well, not so much. We usually covered the same story, but from different sides. So if he was with the coalition forces, for example, in Saudi Arabia, I would be in Iraq. Or if he was interviewing the PLO in Tunis, I would be in Israel. And so we worked together, but we often weren't in the same place together.
When you did turn to fiction, it was to large historical events. Is this because of your background as a journalist?
I think that what intrigues me is how people behave in catastrophe, and that can be on a very small level. My first novel is actually about a village of only about 350 people, and it's a small canvas, but I was intrigued by the true story of the village of Eam in Derbyshire when the bubonic plague came to the village. The villagers came together and took the unique decision to quarantine themselves rather than flee and spread the infection into the surrounding countryside. And so I wanted to imaginatively explore what it would be like to bring a community to a consensus like that, and then to live with the consequences of your decision as your neighbors and your friends and your family die around you.
And then in March, you turned to the missing father in Little Women, Mr. March, who is a background figure in Little Women, but only appears at the very end. And you try to speculate on what happened to him in Virginia during the first year of the Civil War.
In that case, I was intrigued by the issue of what happens to idealists at war. What happens if you believe passionately in a cause? And of course, in Mr. March's case, that cause is abolition. But it can be other causes at other times, and young idealists go off to war for an idea, but then they find that their belief in righteous behavior perhaps is challenged by the essential nature of war, which turns even people fighting on the right side sometimes into torturers and people capable of great atrocity. So I wanted to explore those ideas through a New Englander of idealistic, transcendentalist, abolitionist convictions, and it was, Mr. March was kind of a found object in a way. Louisa May Alcott had given us the premise of such a man away at war, but hadn't told us anything about the war that he experienced.
And you actually based him very largely on her father, Bronson Alcott.
I made his character very much a reflection of Bronson's character. He was a remarkable, radical idealist. He mainly in education, but in all manner of social affairs. He was so far ahead of his time that the school he ran in the Boston of the 1830s would still be considered a progressive school even today.
And he did rather poorly. Well, he made money when he was young and then lost it because he believed in giving money to, say, John Brown and other important causes.
Well, that's my fictional character. Bronson Alcott never made very much money, mm-hmm. because every penny he made, he plowed back into buying beautiful books and accoutrements and busts of Socrates for his classrooms, because he thought it was important for children to learn from beautiful books. So Bronson Alcott was never a wealthy man, but the father in Little Women, Louisa May tells us that the March family had a fortune and lost it, and I had to come up with a plausible explanation for how a man like Mr. March would lose his fortune, and I thought that perhaps he might have lost it funding some of John Brown's wildest schemes to make money to foment the slave uprising that was his great life's mission.
And now in People of the Book, you've actually turned to a beautiful book as the centerpiece, the Sarajevo Haggadah that had been in the Bosnian capital, but was threatened several times, was actually saved by very unlikely people, and now is in real life has been returned, but in your novel undergoes a few more permutations. You wrote a factual article about the fate of the Haggadah in the New Yorker early last winter, or this winter. I assume that you encountered it when you were in Sarajevo.
Indeed. I was there reporting on the UN peacekeeping operations during the siege of Sarajevo, which were quite controversial, if you remember. And there were rumors about this magnificent, rare Hebrew codex that had been created in Spain in 1350, was one of the principal treasures of the Bosnian National Collections, and it was missing. And nobody knew at that time what had happened to it, and there are all kinds of rumors, but the truth was even better than the rumors. It was revealed towards the end of the war that a Muslim librarian had risked his life to go and save it when the museum was being shelled in the early days of the war, and he had taken it to a safe hiding place. And it wasn't the first time that the book had been saved by Muslim hands. I learned that the same thing had happened during World War II, and in that case, the librarian, Dervish Korkut, had hidden the book on his person. He'd sort of tucked it into the waistband of his trousers and pulled his coat over it when a German general came to demand it from the museum library. And he actually walked out of the library and took it up into the mountains and hid it in a mosque for the duration of the war. So these stories started to intrigue me, and then I wanted to learn more, and I found that there isn't a lot more actually known. We know that the book was in Venice in 1609 when it was saved from a book burning by a Catholic priest who wrote that there was nothing heretical in it, and that preserved it. And we know it was created in Spain because the illustrations themselves tell us that, but we don't know who the artist was or indeed why this book was illustrated at a time when Hebrew books generally were not, because of the commandment against making graven images.
In the New York article, there's an illustration from the Haggadah which features a Jewish family at Passover, but a woman with distinctly African features taking part along with the family. In the novel, you use that picture and then some items that are found in the Haggadah as it is being examined by a manuscript expert, butterfly wing, some salt, some blood, some the hair of a cat, and so on, to trace back its original history.
That's right. I got the idea of structuring the book that way because I was very intrigued by all these different stories moving through time, but I didn't know what was going to link them together. And then I thought, well, I could have a conservator working on the book in the near present, and as she finds these clues, if you like, in the binding, each of them takes us on a journey back in time, and we can spend time with the people who created the book and who protected it and who brought it from one place of danger to another.
And along the way, I counted something like 17 major characters over the span of 700 years. In March, you were able to basically deal with one character in 1 year and a couple of the people he encounters, one woman in particular. In this case, you didn't really have much room to examine the characters very carefully because there's so many of them and their situations are so different.
Well, I like to think of the book as a novel that contains some novellas. So we get a glimpse of a bigger story in each of the lives that we visit briefly. And I like to think that there's an invitation to the reader there to fill in the gaps that I don't spell out. So actually, you meet some of the characters before you actually find out who they are, because the book is moving backwards in time. And so you might find out the fate of a character earlier than you've been introduced to that character. So it's kind of a little bit of a puzzle piece for the alert reader to work out that boy selling things in the marketplace of Tarragona is actually a boy that you meet much later in the book, and you find out how he got from where he is to Tarragona.
The title, People of the Book, refers to all the people who are connected by the Haggadah, but it is also a name given, I think, originally by Muslims to Jews, Christians, and Muslims as being the people who share a number of scriptures.
The different groups use that term to describe themselves, to describe others. You know, Jews consider themselves people of the book because of the Torah. Muslims, of course, have the Quran as the sacred text at the heart of their faith. And Christians, you know, the New Testament, the Old Testament. So that term, people of the book, has been used at different times to refer to all those groups, which has a nice resonance.
Yeah, I thought that Muslims actually used it for all three, but I may be wrong.
They do. Yep. They do, okay. Yeah.
So in a way, what you're examining is the interaction of these three religious groups over the 700-800 years. And in some cases, they behave very well toward one another, and in other cases, abominably.
That's right. So that gets to the heart of what interests me as a writer, I guess. It interested me as a journalist and also as a fiction writer, which is how do people behave in a catastrophe? Are they drawn to be their best self or their worst self?
But at the end, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a reconciliation at the end, and it looks like a time of tolerance might be coming back. But that's what people thought in Bosnia 30 years ago, that the racial hatreds and the ethnic hatreds and religious hatreds that had dominated the Balkans ever since the Muslim conquest were maybe had finally been overcome. Then in the 90s, it turned out that they resurfaced more horribly than ever.
It seems to be not just in the Balkans, but it seems to be something that human societies have to contend with over and over again, that we have this wonderful capacity to build brilliant communities where difference is enriching and is celebrated and welcomed. And at those times, we seem to do very well. They tend to be times of prosperity and intellectual exchange and creativity, scientific advancement. That was the case in Spain during the centuries of convivencia, when Christians and Muslims and Jews were living side by side. You could say that was the case in Germany before the rise of Nazism, an incredibly fruitful time for ideas and literature and all those wonderful things. And then this sort of fear and hatred of otherness seems to rise up out of the dark place in the human soul and smashes it all apart, and there's this search for a bland, monocultural society, whether it's the Aryan ideal or the ideal of the ethnic cleansers of the former Yugoslavia, who only want to live with people of their own kind. And that, I think, is as sterile in human society as it is in agriculture and in nature. Monocultures are not not places of creativity and beauty and robustness.
And that, I may be making a somewhat far-fetched comparison, but it struck me that you've gone to from a family study, a character study in March, which in its way is very much like the family study in Little Women, to a book that's more trying to perhaps make a point to show people what is possible and what horrible things can happen otherwise. And the comparison that came up from almost the same time as Little Women would be Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Well, I run about a million miles in the other direction from trying to make a point. I write stories that interest me, and these stories interested me a great deal about why it is that we seem to enact this same tragedy over and over again. But the point is for the reader to draw. And I think that from my own experience as a reader, you draw different points at different times that a book comes into your hands. When I read certain books as an adolescent, I read them getting one particular message. I read them now in my maturity, and I realize that for me right now, there's an entirely different point to be had. And I think every reader has their own, his or her own experience of a book, and they find what they want to take from it. It's not for me to be doling it out and dishing it up.
About the only complaint I have about the book is that you get these descriptions of the Haggadah, but you never actually get to see it. I was felt very lucky to read the New Yorker article where it was actually there. Was there ever any thought of putting any real illustrations in the novel?
No, because it is a novel, and even though it is inspired by the real events of the Sarajevo Haggadah, it's not the Sarajevo Haggadah, and I don't want to create a misrepresentation that I actually know how or why this book was created, how or why it got out of Spain. These are figments of my writerly imagination, and I think to then use the illuminations from the real book would be confounding. On the other hand, I wanted to leave room for the reader to imagine the illumination. So my protagonist, my book conservator, describes some of the images, and I think it's much richer for people to take their own perhaps images that they've seen of illuminated medieval manuscripts and imagine their own fictional Haggadah.
So though your fictions draw heavily on history and fact, you draw a strong, clear line between the two.
I try to. It was harder in this book than in others because this book, some of the inspirations for it are events that were in living memory. But that was what motivated me to do the World War II story of the Haggadah and to set down the factual basis of the story in a piece of nonfiction, in an essay that actually laid out what I had found to be the true story, unvarnished and unmessed with for the purposes of the plot that I was trying to create in the novel.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking for the last 20-some minutes with Geraldine Brooks, author of, among other things, Nine Parts of Desire, March, and now most recently, People of the Book. She'll be appearing as part of the California Lecture Series at the Crest Theater in Sacramento 2 days from now, Wednesday the 6th at 7:30 p.m., and I'm sure you'll hear more than we've had time to talk about in the last 20 minutes. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Eric.
And this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. In the first half of the program, we talked with Geraldine Brooks, author most recently of People of the Book. She'll be appearing at the Crest Theater in Sacramento this Wednesday the 6th at 7:30 p.m. as part of the California Lecture Series. Another person who's going to be appearing, not in Sacramento, but in Nevada and Placer counties in the immediate future, is Jordan Fisher Smith. His book, Nature Noir, which first came out in 2005, is this year's Nevada County Reads selection. It's already been part of several events, but the two major ones are coming up in this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Nevada City Hall. Jordan Fisher Smith will be talking with anyone who wants to come in. I talked with him yesterday. He's considering reading several things. He hasn't quite made up his mind what his presentation is going to be, but he'll make a presentation for maybe an hour, take questions and answers, and he'll be available to sign books for anyone who would like it. That's Thursday, February 7th at 7 p.m. at the Nevada City Hall. And then another bigger event, Mike Lynch, who's the real-life ranger who appears as a character of Dave Finch in Nature Noir, will lead a tour of the Auburn Dam site and the historic ranger station featured in the book. That is limited to 50 pre-registered participants. It's going to be Saturday, February 23rd at 11 a.m., rain or shine. If you're interested in that, it costs $15. You can get a registration form and more information at www.nevadacountyreads.com. You get the registration form there, send it in with your $15, and then you can see Mike Lynch and also Jordan Fisher-Smith at the Auburn Dam site. The book is about his nearly 14 years that he spent as a park ranger on a place that wasn't really quite a park. It was the land that was being kept in reserve, waiting to be inundated by the Auburn Dam, which was first authorized in the 1960s. As it turns out, the dam has never been built. Right now, it looks unlikely unless the political and environmental situation changes very greatly. And we'll hear in just a minute what Jordan Fisher-Smith has to say about his 14 years there. I talked to him yesterday evening, and he was very illuminating. If you want to hear more about this, there is a recording of the interview I did with him 3 years ago. You can go to either the Booktown link on kvmr.org or go to booktown.blogspot.com and go back to February of 2005, where you'll find that that interview as well. I'm actually going to link to that as well on the page for today's program. So without any further talk, let's go to Further Talk, a conversation I had yesterday evening with Jordan Fisher-Smith. I read Nature Noir 3 years ago when it first came out. I picked it up again the other day to look through it to figure out what to talk about. And actually, even before I picked it up, there were quite a few incidents in it that I remembered very clearly. There was the drowning of the young Laotian boy. There was the woman attacked by and killed by a mountain lion. There was the woman whose body disappeared, or who disappeared in a case that may have been a murder. There were the fights among the various miners along the river, the suicides off the bridge, your Lyme disease. This is quite a lot to remember after a three-year interval from a book that's only a little over 200 pages long. How did you pick the particular stories that you chose? Because what, you worked for in this recreation area for 14 years?
Almost 14 years, just a few weeks short of 14 years. So, yeah, I think it was, I mean, this is fairly typical when you have people write a memoir of work in emergency services as a, say, as a paramedic or as a policeman or anything like that, is that what people wind up with is a lot of anecdotal stories involving, you know, moments of terror that don't add up to any one big thing. And this book didn't want to be a collection of little incidents. This book had some larger pathway to walk. And I really think that what the book's about is how people lived in a condemned landscape. As your readers probably know, the book's been out for a couple of years and it's in paperback now. Nature Noir is about a dam site here in the Sierra, just south of Nevada City. Some 42,000 acres of land that the government acquired and some 48 or 50 miles of river that were supposed to have been flooded under what was to be the largest thin arch concrete dam in the world at the time. And through a set of political and environmental and geological machinations, somehow this didn't happen, and still might. The land is still there, it's still condemned on paper, and it could happen. So so this was a laboratory to watch what happened when you had something happen to wild land that's similar to the bad neighborhoods and cities. What I think that all your listeners will be familiar with the feeling of driving into the wrong part of a city and saying, oh no, I notice that everything's covered with writing and paint and that my life is worthless here. And you can pass literally a couple blocks and be in an entirely different environment. And somehow it seemed to me that the land or the landscape gives a message about whether life is worth something here, or whether the land or the landscape is worth something, or whether it isn't. And so I decided to write a book about this condemned landscape and the people in it.
You said that as you would be on patrol, there was an invisible line along the hills where the water level eventually would be. And you had the feeling that everything below this line was probably not worth preserving.
I don't think I said that exactly. I think I said, to me, it was very worth preserving, but the Congress had already said that it wouldn't be, and so the land beneath the waterline, these thousands of acres beneath this waterline, lived on in the same way somebody lives on who's got terminal cancer. They're still among us, but we, you know, when we visit them, we stop talking about what we might do next Christmas together. Or, you know, are you going to hot summer nights next summer? Because they're there now, but one has the sense they won't be. This is the way this landscape was. It was a beautiful place, but you could stand on the bottom of the canyon, look upstream and down, and everything that you could see was as good as gone. And that utterly changed everything that went on there.
And it made it much more difficult to enforce certain regulations. You couldn't necessarily one of the things you tried very much to take away illegal weapons from people there. Your fellow rangers weren't so concerned about that because somehow they didn't have the same zeal they might in a park, a designated park rather than a recreation area that they knew was going to be there for hundreds or thousands of years.
I think that's right, but I mean anybody with a lick of sense wouldn't have had any zeal for risking their life for a place that was already condemned to go underwater. Why I did it or why I began doing it, I don't know. I'm not proud of that, but it might have been stupid. But it seemed to me that the only thing that we'd been giving this charge to take care of this place pending its inundation as a sort of accident of history, of political history. The park, the state parks was responsible for, would be responsible for running this place as a recreational lake in the same way that Folsom Lake or Lake Oroville are run, or Lake Powell or Lake Mead, these places where you have water skiers and campgrounds along the waterline. When it was finished, well, as the time went on and the dam wasn't finished, and they began having many, many problems with people below the waterline, somebody got the bright idea to send the rangers in early. But by rights, this group of people who thought they might be spending their lives watching over the crown jewels of America never should have been there.
And
it was a great insult to their, I think, to their idealism as rangers for them to have to do that.
And this was at a time of budget cuts as well.
Well, in the beginning, they had quite a staff there. They had a staff of 15 when they started out, and they really set out to do what they could there. But as the political fortunes of the dam went on and went into a kind of doldrums, and the Reagan administration came in and was making a show of cutting the domestic budget while pouring money into the black budget and military budget, the budget for these rangers was cut. And by the time I encountered them, you had, you know, four or five dispirited rangers working down there with 42,000 acres of territory full of people with guns. And it was a ridiculously dangerous and crazy-making situation for a ranger to be in.
I think you confiscated something like 125 guns in your time.
As I recall, the figure was that in the first 8 years of my tenure there, I confiscated 108 weapons and of every possible description. I had more than one. I had a couple of AK-47s, all kinds of assault rifles, lots and lots of concealed pistols. And in many cases, these were used in heinous ways to either threaten somebody or shoot at somebody or possessed by a felon or, you know, all kinds of things other than just that somebody happened to have a gun in there.
But there was the place didn't just attract riffraff. There were lots of very decent and honorable people.
Well,
in there.
These two rivers had been developing a huge reputation as among California's best whitewater rivers. So you had kayakers and rafters coming on the river, and you had sort of a small group of dedicated hikers and naturalists and so on. And it was my idea that if we began to sort of pacify the place, in other words, we made it safe to be there, that these people would be encouraged to make common cause with it and step in and try to save it. So that was my thinking, and it probably was some of the other rangers thinking about what we were doing there.
And that's actually what did happen in the end.
That indeed has happened, and the rangers are still there to this day. They began in 1977, so they've been there now, you know, for a long time. And they've built trails, they've built little makeshift campgrounds. They are now, they have a docent group that leads nature walks there. And they are treating the land beneath the waterline of the dam as if it mattered.
Because now it looks as if the Auburn Dam might never get built, but the law has never been repealed.
Yeah, I don't actually know that, that it will never get built. I think that, you know, California in historic times has never had longer than about a six-year drought. We had a six-year drought in, 1987 to 92. Two inclusive, I think that's right, and there was a couple of years of severe drought in the late 70s. There was one in the late 20s and early 30s, but the fossil record in tree rings, the dendrochronology record, tells us that California had a 150-year drought and a 200-year drought around the end of the first millennium. So if we have even a 5 or 10 year drought, I am very confident that somebody will try to get the Auburn Dam built again. And as long as the land is owned by a dam building agency and the dam hasn't been officially decommissioned, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't.
What did you take from your 14 years on this site? You had to leave. When you first started out, it wasn't the place you would have chosen.
I thought it was the worst possible luck to get stuck there. And when I first went to work there, I thought I'd leave as soon as I had a year's worth of hours. That was the plan. It was a stopping point. I never thought of it as a job I would stay in for very long. And I can't tell you exactly why I stayed, but as time went on, and especially by the time I'd finished this book, I realized that it was the biggest stroke of luck I'd ever had. Because my work as a writer, it seems to me, has centered around, or the hub of my work is the question of how do you live in the world when you know you're in the middle of the largest extinction in 65 million years and now global climate change. And to be a park ranger whose job is to protect a landscape that's already condemned to go underwater was a laboratory for learning how to live in this time in history and learning how to write about it. So it was a great stroke of luck for me.
And there are dozens of people who have written about Yosemite and Yellowstone and other places where you worked.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, in some way, as a writer, one gets what one gets. And I didn't value this experience for years because it was so difficult and dangerous. But now I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me to go there.
And you didn't, just as you didn't really start out voluntarily, or certainly not enthusiastically, you didn't quit voluntarily either.
No, I didn't. And Nature Noir, this book that I've written, tells the story of my having gotten bitten by a tick. I ended up chasing some guy through the brush, which we did many times for one reason or another. Some deputy sheriff was down there chasing this guy, and I went to assist. And somewhere in there I got a tick on me and didn't know about it. The tick stayed on me overnight and I found it the next day. And I got Lyme disease and got very ill, so I was forced to retire from rangering and in some way still carry part of the canyons inside me now.
And it took you half a dozen years to really recover?
I guess
you never really recover.
Well, I mean, I'm doing a lot better, and as of right now, I've been off antibiotics for something over 7 months, which is the first time since January of 2000 that I've been off that long.
Leaving under those circumstances may seem like it disrupted something that you were really getting involved in, but it's probably a, if you want to call it, symbolic ending for this strange enterprise.
Yeah, I mean,
in that
it was
you know, humans fooling around where they shouldn't be, or these ticks who aren't really native to the area.
Well, the ticks are, but the disease may not be.
Right.
And if the disease indeed was here, it was under some kind of control by some other factor. The reasons why Lyme disease has suddenly Lyme and other tick-borne diseases have suddenly become a big problem in America is we don't understand fully. It does appear in certain parts of the country that global climate change encourages the ticks. In other words, that warmer winters are good for ticks. But I also carried away from that experience a rich appreciation. The old saying, nature bats last, may come really in the form of bacteria. There's a sort of arms race going on between medical professionals and bacteria, with new antibiotics on one side and bacteria's immense ability to evolve quickly and change their makeup to evade antibiotics. And it does appear now that the diseases like Lyme that pass from animals to humans are the big diseases of the 21st century. Bird flu is one of those, or was reputed to be. West Nile virus is one of those. So I came away from this experience again enriched in, it was a tough way to learn, but enriched in my understanding of what's going on in the world. And
you said your main concern as a writer is being in the midst of the greatest mass extinction in 65 million years, and then climate change. These are probably
Bill McKibben said, I saw Bill recently at some conference, and he said, well, when I realized what was going on, I thought, what else is there to write about?
Yeah, absolutely.
It trumps just about every other issue out there.
So what are you writing about now? This book has been out for 3 years, been very successful.
Well, I do some magazine work, and then I'm at work on another book that'll come out in 2010. At first, when I had finished with the book tours with Nature Noir, both for the hardcover and paperback, I did something like 77 book signings and lectures in 13 states, and you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of media interviews. And at the end of that, I thought I'd never want to write about Rangers again. But then I began looking at what readers had said they wanted or what they liked, and I thought, this is something I know about. So I undertook to write another book about public lands in the Sierra and a story. It's not the same story as Nature Noir, but a story of a big landscape in the Sierra. And that's what I'm at work at now.
And do you tie that in with mass extinction and climate change, or is
well,
it
nothing's
more
untouched. Yeah, nothing's untouched by that. So, you know, to me, that's my work. My work is not specifically about nature, but about how do we live now in full knowledge of what's going on. I mean, how do we go through our days and not become emotionally dead, you know, from the effect of knowing what's happening? How do we stay alive?
There's a local website that was drawn to my attention, somewhat criticizing the point of view of the Gandhian point of view of be the change you want to see, criticizing environmentalists for trying to reduce their own carbon footprint, and saying that's not enough. You really have to change the whole system, and I totally agree with that. But I have no idea how to do it because there's so many people who aren't listening.
I'm awfully critical of people who are critical.
Yeah,
I think that Arne Næss, the great professor emeritus at Oslo University in Norway, and the guy who's credited with sort of inventing this deep ecology, said the frontier is long, and by that he means that the frontier is sort of a term from war, old time war, and that there's need for lots and lots of people to appear on the frontier to fight at different places. And I see absolutely no reason why there should be this sort of recriminations and mutual finger pointing between one or another kind of environmentalist about who's doing the best work or what kind of work a person should do. To live in this time, ultimately one has to find what works for oneself.
I've heard another person say that this is essentially a 10,000 year struggle, beginning from the time when humans really began to domesticate animals and plants and settle down, and that we're just beginning to get a handle on how to deal with everything we've unleashed.
I think that's very true. You know, you really are looking at the trajectory of human beings from the Paleolithic forward, or from the Neolithic to forward, or from the domestication of animals. And when you domesticate animals and you begin having fields, many environmental philosophers or environmental historians have said that's where you begin being in a state of war with nature, that you are subject to plagues of grasshoppers or wolves and coyotes who take your sheep. And probably that and the development of the first cities are the two great moments when you see the trajectory forming toward where we are now. And it is this attitude that we have to sort of subdue or overcome the next limits to human life that will, of course, undo us.
That was Jordan Fisher Smith in a conversation I recorded yesterday evening. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm almost out of time. Before I leave, though, I'd like to remind you about the people I've been talking with this afternoon. Jordan Fisher Smith's Nature Noir, which came out 3 years ago, was this year, or still is, this year's Nevada County Reads selection. There have been a number of public events in the last couple of weeks where people can meet with Jordan in different ways, talk with him, see his books, and also where reading groups have met. Two more are still coming up. One is an evening with Jordan Fisher Smith, which is his first talk in Nevada County since his 2005-2006 book tour. This is going to be at the Nevada City City Hall on Thursday, February 7th at 7 p.m. City Hall's at 317 Broad Street. It says here that he'll talk about how this strange little book from the foothills was well received all over the nation. A question and answer period will follow, during which the author will talk about how books get published, what will happen to the American River, and how the foothills will fare during global climate change. He'll be happy to sign books. That's a free event this Thursday, February the 7th. A more elaborate event is a tour of the Auburn Dam site. Mike Lynch, the real-life ranger who appears as the character of Dave Finch in Nature Noir, will lead a tour of the Auburn Dam site and the historic ranger station featured in the book. This is limited to 50 people, will cost $15, all of which goes to Nevada County Reads. If you're interested in taking part in that, you should go to www.nevadacountyreads.com, and there's a registration form you can fill out and send in with your $15. That tour will take place on Saturday, the 23rd of February, 11 a.m., rain or shine. You can hear this interview and any Booktowns by going to the Booktown link on kvmr.org or booktown.blogspot.com. To hear the earlier interview I did with Jordan Fisher Smith, you can go back to February of 2005 in the archives there, or you can go to today's program and I will have a link to the earlier interview. Probably, maybe up today, certainly in the next day or two. Earlier in the program, I talked with Geraldine Brooks. She's best known for her book, Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden Life of Muslim Women, which came out about a dozen years ago. Three novels since then, including March, which won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize, and People of the Book, which has just been published. It's already on the San Francisco Chronicle and New York Times bestseller lists. She'll be appearing at the Crest Theater in Sacramento this Wednesday at 7 p.m. That's part of the California Lectures, California Lecture Series. That's Geraldine Brooks at the Crest Theater this Wednesday, Jordan Fisher Smith at Nevada City Hall this Thursday. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned now for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.